Hi Founders, I'm Louis Nichols and you're listening to the Sales for Founders podcast, where each week you can learn all of the sales skills that you need to find your first customers and grow a profitable business, directly from the mouths of some of the most successful founders and sales experts out there. This week, I am so excited to talk to Stephanie Hurlburt. Stephanie is one of my all-time favorite founders. She co-founded her company Binomial as a developer with no real sales background. Soon, she found herself closing six and seven figure deals with massive customers like Netflix, Magic Leap, and Activision. We're going to look at a whole range of sales stuff today, from advice for first-time founders to how to approach, nurture, and win B2B contracts. But before we get into that though, I want to remind you that enrollment for the Sales for Founders course closes this Sunday. So if you're fed up of not running your own profitable business, and you're finally ready to change that, then head on over to salesforfounders.com. And there you can sign up to join other founders just like you, where you'll learn how to build a product people want to buy, how to find your first customers, and how to grow your product into a profitable business. Anyway, let's dive into today's episode. Stephanie, it is so awesome to have you here with me today. Why don't you kick us off by telling listeners a little bit about who you are?
I'm Stephanie. So I'm an entrepreneur. I run a small business that sells image compression software to other companies. We primarily do software licensing. In the past, we've done consulting as well. And we work with a lot of big companies. It's not the kind of company that sells small licenses to thousands of people. We typically work with a smaller set of customers.
Great. And we is you and your co-founder, Rich, right?
Me and my co-founder, Rich Geldrick. Yep.
Awesome. And how did you guys meet?
We met, I think the brief answer is just networking. Like At the time, I was pretty sure I was going to quit my job and start consulting. And I knew that to get gigs, you had to network a lot. And so I was just talking to a lot of people. And he was one of the people I kind of talked to who was in my industry. And we just really got along.
Awesome. It's funny how those kind of things happen.
It is.
And whereabouts are you based at the moment?
Seattle, Washington.
Awesome. Now let's dive into the sales stuff. So Stephanie, obviously you had to learn sales the hard way on the job at Binomial. What's a mistake or maybe a lesson you learned in the early days that was maybe a bit different to what you expected sales to be like and you think is really important for other founders to hear about and to understand so they don't make the same mistake?
Like a most recent one was after failing epically on a negotiation with a larger company, I was able to learn from a lot of those mistakes. For instance, one mistake I made was realizing that like everybody I was talking to had a different motivation in the company. Mm-hmm. And one thing I was able to do to make the deal go a little smoother is once I got to the business contact in the company, the procurement department, give them a bit of a discount at that stage to kind of make them look good to their boss and help smooth the deal over, and price the product purposefully higher knowing that that discount was going to come. And just all these little things that I never wanted to know, but like help the process go smoother.
Yeah. I mean, those are just, they're crazy things, right? When you try and explain that to someone doing enterprise sales for the first time, that there's someone in that company whose job is just to get a discount and that's how they get appraised. So they don't really care what the price is. They just care about kind of hitting their KPI.
Yes, exactly. Like you go in thinking like my product's valuable and you kind of view everybody at the company as if they have the same mindset, but they don't. In fact, one of the biggest challenges we encounter is programmers acknowledging that our software is better and extremely valuable and not wanting to push it forward because it replaces their code. And they're like, I don't want my code to be replaced. I'm like, but. So like that, it's very tricky to navigate large groups of people.
Yeah, I bet that must be, it's just everything, I guess, when you're doing those larger deals, everything runs slower. I mean, there'll be there's a department as well whose job is just to make sure they pay you at the last minute as far as they can possibly push it out and all that kind of stuff. It's yeah.
Yeah. And one thing that, that I didn't realize when I started that I know now is how to get those larger deals, like upward of seven figures and such, is I learned that at least where I'm at, they never come right away. You never say, like, I haven't been able to say, like, my price is seven figures. This is just what it is. Mm-hmm. It's always like a negotiation and starting smaller and like usually the culmination of a year or two of like breaking it down and getting to that larger price.
Awesome. Maybe we could use that then as a way to kind of, can we talk about maybe the first time you did one of those kind of larger deals? Cause I know from kind of listening to your other stuff and looking at your talks that your first customer was, I'm going to get it wrong now. Your first customer was Netflix, right?
Yeah, that was our first person, customer that we really brought on board. That wasn't like one of those crazy large deals. Mm-hmm. It was more like, let's get our foot in the door, let's get something. And they were actually kind enough to do a pre-order before the product was even built, which was extra nice of them. Yeah. So they gave us some money up front to kind of build it. And then once it was built, they got to lock in a license price and things like that.
That's awesome. Could you give us like a really, really short breakdown of the actual steps involved there? So like, I think a lot of people, they don't even realize like the timeline involved, right? They might be thinking, is this a week? Is this a month? Is this a year? Because I think it's longer than most people would expect.
That was a highly unusual deal in the fact that we were advertising this product. We had built kind of, I don't know if it would be an MVP because it wasn't even working. It was more like a proof of concept that it could work. Mm-hmm. And we had posted benchmarks with that proof of concept. And Netflix actually reached out to us and they were like, we would be interested. And we were able to close that within a manner of 2 to 3 months, which is unheard of and has never happened since. Gave me a very bad introduction to enterprise sales. But the reason, looking back, I realized we were able to close it so quickly because it was a consulting agreement. And it was like a hacked up consulting agreement. Basically, their standard services agreement with two clauses. One clause said that it was all our IP and nothing was their IP. And the other clause locked in license terms. So it was able to process so quickly because they stamp out consulting agreements every day. It's no big deal.
Okay. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. And then, so you were off to the races. You thought, oh, this is going to be easy. And then customer two.
And after that, I think our next, we took on several customers simultaneously after that in negotiation, but one I really learned from was a very large company that we have been negotiating with for almost 3 years now, and it still hasn't closed, and that's because I made so many mistakes along the way that I've been able to learn from, but it really, like, ever since then, 12 to 18 months minimum has been the sales cycle.
Okay, awesome. Well, could you maybe dive into a couple of those mistakes, the painful ones that other people will make especially?
So I jumped in essentially wanting that seven-figure deal right away. Like, I was like, okay, this is done. I barely knew anyone in the company. I only knew, like, the engineering team. I didn't understand how all those worked. And we would have negotiations about the prices. And I also just did really badly in the negotiation. It was just embarrassing. And I think they could just tell that I wasn't that experienced and that the company had not done deals like this. And that made them kind of lose faith in the company. That, along with the large price point right up front. What I should have done, and they were giving me hints that I should do this, is do a smaller deal, like 5 to 6 figures with only one part of the company. But lesson learned.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult to kind of to navigate those things. I mean, it's different by company as well, I suppose. They all have slightly different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure that I've talked to entrepreneurs who take more top-down approaches, like people who've been able to network with VPs and executives, and they are able to get the larger deals right out the door more easily than I am. I'm still learning how to do that side of it.
Do you think that's maybe slightly product dependent? Because I think your product doesn't directly, or it's the link to kind of the cost savings and the bottom line are maybe a bit further away than maybe a sales tool or something like that, that you can maybe kind of push in top down a bit easier.
It's so tricky because I hesitate to agree because I think it's more a failure in my pitching skills. Okay. I've gotten really good at pitching to engineers because I was an engineer. I know the value, and I've even gotten good at pitching to middle management and business that works fairly close with the engineers. We've been able to say, for instance, to video games, we're going to cut your download sizes by 30%. And that's like a very clear value proposition. But I haven't gotten so good at pitching to like high level, like people who are very removed from the product teams.
Okay. But
yeah,
it seems to be working for you, kind of going bottom up anyway. So
It's working all right.
That's awesome. Because I think that's something maybe you can say a couple of words about that, because it's something I think a lot of people don't realize is that or this is my experience. Please tell me if you think it's different. But what I've seen is that there's, when you think about pricing, there's basically an amount that an employee, like a programmer or a product manager or whoever, they can put that on a credit card. They don't need to ask anybody. Normally it's maybe up to about $1,000 a month or something like that. And you can get that approved in 5 minutes. And then everything above that takes way longer, whether you ask for 10K or 100K or a million a month. It takes the same process. So there's like a dead zone in the middle where it's not really even worth doing anything.
That is very common advice I hear, is to not get caught in that dead zone or that death price of like, it's not even worth our time. Or I found that it also just signals product quality, where it's like, if your price is this low, which actually isn't low to most people, but low to these businesses, it must not be a good product. I'm thankful that I started higher. It's better than to start too high than it is to get caught in that death price.
That's awesome. Okay. So maybe we can kind of, let's say binomial, something terrible happens. Gaming and graphics is made illegal and you have to come up with a new business, and somehow you stumble upon this great idea this great product that you know corporates, enterprises really need. You don't have any customers. You have your current network, however you want to call it. How would you go about getting that first sale? What do you think, if you're kind of in the position that quite a few founders will be in?
I think my first approach would be talking to other entrepreneurs in that space.
Yeah.
Like I know image compression and game middleware really well right now, and I know pretty much a lot of people in that space. I would first do that. I would try to get a sense of what they charged, what roadblocks they faced, basically feel confident in the position I'm coming into. Yep. And then the next step after that would be to network and try to meet actual customers.
Okay. So you would want to meet the customers first? Would you be more interested in meeting the decision maker, or would you be looking to meet the person who would be using the product? I think it's really hard for someone who maybe has absolutely no experience of this kind of thing whatsoever to even visualize, what is this? Is this me meeting my friend who's a developer at this company for a coffee and getting a contact to someone via that? Is this me going to a networking event and meeting someone there? Is this me cold emailing? Where would you start? I mean, I know there's loads of different ways of doing it, but what would be your kind of, what would you tell someone over a coffee to do?
Right. And that's part of why I mentioned I would talk to other entrepreneurs first. Because one thing I've discovered is that it's heavily industry dependent how you approach this. For instance, in the game industry, which is where we do a lot of sales, anything that remotely smells like business is like, nope, I don't want to talk to you. So you have to approach it so casually. You have to really like, and coffees with developers, things like that. And it's, you have to walk this fine line between like, yes, this is casual, but like not leading people on in a, like it's a very tricky line to walk. Whereas in other businesses, they're used to like networking events and more like business first approaches. So it kind of depends, but either way you can start a deal. We had one of our really big deals started with a junior developer. So like you can start really like from anywhere.
Okay, awesome. This is amazing because I can walk through all the problems that I'm having and I've kind of experienced with sales and just get an answer. So it's amazing. Maybe the next one leading on from that, which I've had problems with before. I know pretty much everybody has problems with it when they start off, is let's say we've got to that point. I've reached out to a friend. He's introduced me to another friend who would be really interested in using my product at a larger company. That person's really excited. They go away, they're interested, they think they understand the value to them of using it. How do you kind of, how do you take it to the next step? How do you make sure firstly that you get a meeting with whoever you need to have a meeting with or a call? And also how do you avoid what sometimes happens, which is you have a week of silence and then the person who was really excited coming back and saying, oh, I talked to my boss about this, I'm afraid we can't do it.
Wow. Yeah. This was something I really messed up on in the early stages. I stupidly used to just send the paid license to this like a junior developer, whatever, no eval, no nothing. Just like, here you go, buy my product now. And since then we've refined our process a little bit. Usually what I'll ask is, I'll try to get on a call with their manager. If I can't, I'll try to basically equip them with sales tools, because I'm not there, and especially if they're engineers, they probably don't know how to sell. So I have to kind of like equip them with the language, like here are the bullet points you can tell your manager, and like give them the tools. And then beyond that, also make it really easy to engage with us. So we offer free evaluations for 30 days. We have a contract we can just send, get signed real fast, and then get the product in their hands fast. We've started to refine that a little bit for larger companies that are more high risk and have already shown significant interest. We'll sometimes go straight in with a paid evaluation. So it kind of, it depends.
Okay. That's awesome. And so you basically provide them kind of with a, you say it's like a PDF or like a one pager or something to take with them, or
what that does that would look be like? Professional. I keep getting asked for that. I don't have that, but I should have that. Yes, you should do that. But I so far have just, we have a few slide decks that we've done. I really need to clean up and shorten, but I'll usually just put it in the email text. Like I'll give them some key bullet points. I'll link them to some blog posts that we've written showing technical benchmarks. I'll even insert some images of benchmarks. Just try to give them some tools like that. It should be a PDF, but...
or whatever.
There's always things to do.
Sure. Okay. A link to a Google doc or something they can't open because of the their like firewall or whatever. It's always a great one. So it's kind of sticking on the same topic when you're thinking about those larger deals. I think two questions that I've started asking over the last couple of years that at the beginning I didn't and have made a really big difference are, maybe the first one would be when you're talking, especially to someone who's more junior at the beginning of the sales process, is just to ask, look, have you been through this procedure before? Have you bought something before? That's one. And then the other one that that I like to do a lot is just to ask, assuming they have been through this before and they know what they're doing, is then to ask, okay, if we're going to make this work, who else is involved? Who, you know, what are the steps that we have to go through to get this running up and running? I'm sure you have a load of great questions that you like to ask as well, and that maybe people like me 2 years ago or whatever wouldn't have thought to ask. Have you kind of got any off the top of your head that you think, okay, this is something I need to check out that isn't obvious?
Yeah, actually, and your question about, like, have you done this before is so valuable and so underrated. I recently ran into a few scenarios, because sometimes people will be very confident about the process. They'll be like, this will take 3 months, and it takes a year because they've never done it before, but they'll be very confident. So asking that question is so key. I think for me, I ask a lot of questions. I ask kind of like two branches of questions. I ask technical questions so that because what I found is later in the negotiation process with business people, they'll often play games like say, oh, your product's not actually that valuable. I get that technical data from the technical team showing it is valuable so that I'm prepared later on when that happens. And then the other thing I'll ask is I'll ask questions around if there's a way to start small, because that's one of the biggest things I've learned. Like, can we just use this in your team at first? Like, how can we limit the scope? Because I don't want this to drag on for 3 years. I want to get it in your company sooner.
Great. And leading on from that, there's actually a question that someone on Twitter asked me to ask you, which is, let's say you're talking with one of these customers. They're interested and they ask you for a feature that you don't currently have on your roadmap, or the product doesn't currently do. What do you think about that? Like, how would you approach that? I have a couple of ideas, but I'd love to hear, kind of without putting any words in your mouth, I'd love to hear what you think.
To hear your ideas too. It's so great. Like, I feel like I can learn a lot from you on this call. For me, we get that all the time. And I always think back to when we first started the business, there were a few feature sets we were considering. And the loudest feature set was ones for console and desktop. And then we could also go in a completely different direction and build a compressor for mobile, like phones. Everybody in the console and desktop space was being like, yes, we need this compressor. Not one of them paid us until 2 to 3 years in.
Great.
The phones were willing to pay us right away. And that's one thing I learned right away is just because people are really loud about wanting something doesn't mean they'll actually pay you. And so what I usually say is listen, what we used to do is we used to offer services agreements. And we still kind of do that sometimes, where we're like, how about you pay us a certain amount of money to build it, and like similar to what we did with Netflix. But more often than not, what I do these days is I say, let's get you licensing something. Like, often they'll ask for a higher quality version. I'll like, let's get you licensing the lower quality, and if you're licensing that and you're serious, we'll make that high quality version for you. But like, yeah, stuff like that.
Okay. Oh, awesome.
Yeah. That makes sense. Well, how would you approach it? I want to know.
I'm definitely not saying that I would do it the right way. I think something that I do that maybe not everyone, or that I only started doing later because I would go out, and especially being slightly technical, you know, the first couple of products I was working on, it was, I'll go out and talk to someone. I'll get, yeah, we'd like to buy this, but we need this one more thing. So I'd be like, oh, well, I can build this one more thing, no problem. So I'll just go do that then, which is a terrible thing to do. Don't do that, anybody. But I think something I started doing was, especially when you have more than one person involved in the sales process, is just to ask, you know, why do you ask? Why do you want this? And a lot of the time people just say, well, we were just asking, that might be something that we'd like at some point. Like, literally, like half the time you can just sidestep it completely, which is
that's brilliant.
It's a really silly thing that I can't believe I've never done before. Just because normally you panic and go, well, we could do this and we can put it in the roadmap there, or we can have a services agreement. And they're like, well, we just wanted to know if it was there, you know. It's just an interesting thing to ask. So that's probably the main kind of really stupid mistake I made when it comes to that.
That's really smart.
Well, I think it's less smart and more just a lack of panicking, I think, is the main one.
For sure. Yeah. And I think for me, in our industry, I can kind of tell, there are certain things that I know, like if they're asking about desktop and they're not going to go for mobile, like there are certain things mm-hmm. where you can tell, okay, this isn't just a nice to have, but it's true. It's important to clarify that.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of the time as well, they'll ask if you have a feature when really they're worried about a certain functionality. And people, especially business people tend to talk in terms of features and not necessarily the functionality. So they will ask, you know, does your product have this? Does it do that? When really they mean, are we going to be able to achieve this goal? Or like, are we going to be able to send this data there or whatever it is? And
Exactly. I strongly believe the customer's always right, but they don't always know what the right solution is. Yeah. Like, meaning they're always saying a very true experience, but it's good to get at the underlying problem, like you said.
Yeah. I think something, I don't know if you've seen that before, something I see a lot when I'm really in the early days and looking for trying to, you know, get those first customers on board, is it's so easy if you start talking about that. If you talk about the product and not the, let's say the pain point that you want to solve for the customer, then all of a sudden the customer turns into this kind of consultant entrepreneur on your shoulder who starts giving you these weird, you know, they want to help you by saying, oh, you know what you should do, you know what you should build. And they're kind of critiquing your product instead of actually telling you useful stuff about how they'd like to use it. And that's something I always have to watch out for, that I don't suddenly have like a co-founder who is just trying to give me kind of product ideas. Maybe that's my own personal problem. Maybe that's, yeah.
It's so important. No, I have that problem too. It's important to I have really struggled with setting good expectations up front. Like, for instance, I have stopped we have this inbox that's specifically for new customers, like new inquiries. And we're very careful about like the pace that we take on new customers. And I've stopped apologizing for taking a few weeks to respond to that inbox, because I don't want our relationship to like kick off right away with me saying sorry. Like all those little expectations are really important to set.
Okay. Well, I'm obviously, being British, every conversation starts off with me saying sorry. So that's kind of, that's part of the course. That's fine.
I've noticed the cultural differences. I found that in the US, like, I'm sorry is more taken as like I did something wrong. Yeah. Like genuinely, I really messed up. And so, you know, you have to be a little more careful about how you say it.
Yeah, it's weird how that kind of stuff works. It's one thing I've seen. I do a lot of sales into Germany and German-speaking countries, and just Europe in general. And it is amazing, because everyone has their phone number, their email address, a photo of them on the website, and they get hardly any sales calls, they get hardly any emails, and they will reply. And then in the time it takes you to have a decent phone call with someone who you could potentially sell to, that's the time it takes to ring like 50 different companies in the US and be asked, yeah, what do you want? Who are you trying to get in touch with? No, thank you. They're not here. It's just so much easier.
This is one thing I actually want to learn more about, because we're starting to do more international business. And I have found that it is really easy for me to sell to Canadian companies in the UK, and then of course the United States. Beyond that, there are certain like cultural barriers that I haven't, like, for instance, doing business in Japan is very different than doing business in the US. Like, I'm learning all these things and struggling with it.
Yeah. I think Patrick McKenzie has a lot of amazing stuff on doing business in Japan. So I've never tried it. No,
Yes, one useful resource someone sent me was the Huff Studies Dimensions to kind of visualize how different cultures are different.
Okay, I have to look that up.
Yeah, so. Like for instance, in like Denmark and Sweden and the Netherlands, there's a really low masculinity index.
Yes.
But other than that, it's very similar to the US. So it's like, I find that I often am way too aggressive and need to tone that down a little bit.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if I've seen that. What I've definitely seen is, I think it's weird that companies, this may not be the case in the everywhere in the US, because I've only done sales kind of on the coasts, mm-hmm. In more in the bigger cities. But there, when you go to, especially to a smaller business, I think, and you say, look, I have something that I think is going to help you. I think it's going to increase your revenue, help you or decrease your costs or whatever it is. A lot of them will take a meeting with you just to find out what it is, because the competition is so brutal that if they don't do it and it turns out to be amazing and their competitors do, then they're at a real disadvantage. And there are a lot of places, I'm not sure about Japan. I know a lot of places in mainland Europe are like this, where they'll say, well, if my customers don't know about it, my competitors aren't using it yet, then I don't need to worry about it because I'm fine. And that's a really difficult one to get around.
And I found that that's partially cultural, and that's partially a symptom of just, what was the term used? So we ran into this. Remember how I was saying that our mobile sales were like instant? We instantly got mobile sales. And then PC and console took like 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. I was talking to someone experienced in business, and he said that that's because, what was it? I think the term was like majority market or something. It's this phenomena where like they basically want to see their competitors using it before they use it. And in the industries I sell to, the larger game companies are very much like that. And I think the mindset is like, it's worse to make making a mistake is really costly and really bad.
Yeah.
So they'd rather play it safe than like take a risk, even if that risk could really pay off.
That's a really interesting point. I think there's something I want to get into a bit deeper there as well, is that I think especially when you get to the bigger companies that you're selling into, I assume something that probably a lot of people don't realize is that there's risk and reward on a company level and also on a personal level, right? So there's, will this make or break the company? And will this make or break my career? And those two, not necessarily the same thing at all. So I'd love to hear how you kind of do you have to think about that a lot? Is that something that you kind of factor in? How do you maybe kind of give people a gentle nudge and make them feel okay if they're making the right decision? Maybe you have some case studies, or I don't know, however you do it. I'd love to hear how you get along with that.
Right. So basically the danger to their career is they don't want to make this big referral to a company that turns out not to be reputable, because that would really damage their internal reputation in the company.
Yeah,
navigated a few ways. Like one is that we still could work on is cleaning up our website, having the website look very reputable, having customers that we've worked with on the website so that like right away they get this impression that they can show to their manager that we're mm-hmm. reputable. But I've also found that just in-person meetings are so powerful and something that you can do really early stage, and approaching those in-person meetings with the right attitude and the right pitch.
Mm-hmm.
I found like, for instance, it was like all kinds of little things. Like it was very important not to look too desperate like the way we phrase things, like all kinds of little cues that basically say like, we're a stable business. We know what we're doing. In the beginning of the business, we referenced a lot our past careers. Like we both had worked at very big companies, so we obviously had experience. Now being in business for over 3 years is playing to our advantage in that, like, how bad can we be? We're still around, like, yeah, all kinds of things.
Yeah. And have you tried to get like accreditation or anything like that? Or maybe are there like organizations that you've become a part of? I don't know, publications you've been in, just anything that I'd be interested to hear kind of how you, is that something you've systematically thought about, or is that just something that kind of it's happened along the way and it's been nice to have, but not really important?
Oh no, it's been critical to look reputable and to look like, you know, we're leaders in our field and things like that. Joining the Kronos Group has really helped us. The Kronos Group is kind of a standards body and an organization within graphics, but they don't let in just anyone. And we're actually spec editor of one of the committees, which kind of like, I don't know, it's just this political thing that people can look at that and say, oh wow, if they let you in, like you must be credible. So yeah, there's all kinds of things like that.
Yeah, I heard a quote once, or something like, "No one ever got fired for hiring McKinsey." I think it's the thing, right? There's if you can kind of make sure you won't get the blame for hiring someone, because you can say, "Well, look, they look fine." You know, how was I supposed to know? Which
exactly, and I think the evaluations really help in that regard as well. Like giving them something to evaluate, and then they can clearly see, like before they go too high up the management chain, okay, this does work, we're safe. And then they can continue.
Yeah. So how do you scope one of those evaluations? Because I imagine it's really important to know what you want to achieve and what you want to prove before you start. So how do you say I'm starting a company today where I can do something like that, what would you tell me to do? What kind of steps should I take?
Yeah, and we actually have our free evaluation template available on the internet. We put it on our GitHub, so anyone can take a look at it. But basically, it's a 30-day, usually 30 days. We sometimes increase it to 60 if it's a big company that can't do anything fast. and then beyond 60, it needs to be paid. Okay. We offer either 30 to 60 days or 6 months of a paid evaluation. Mm-hmm. And that gives them a clear trade-off that they can decide. And then beyond that, it's just making sure that the clauses are very good. Like, for instance, one of the clauses says you can only use this for evaluation purposes. Yeah. Another clause is an audit clause that basically lets us hire an auditor if we feel like they might have misused the software, and the auditor will examine their computer and make sure it's not taken. That one is a very contentious clause that we're more and less lenient on depending on the company,
so I wanted to dive into as well around that kind of evaluation period is, I think from my experience, there's basically been two ways that you can handle one of those successfully. And the first one, which doesn't happen very often, I don't think is, but maybe the case for you, is that if you can get someone to evaluate it, because your product takes so much work to integrate and get to know, that basically if you can get them to evaluate it, that basically converts to a sale. I think that's one way to do it, which is if they install it, then we're going to be okay. And then the other way is when you say, okay, if I just give you this for 30 days, then I know nothing's going to happen and I'll lose you. So at the beginning, we really need to define, what are you trying to do? Like, what would make this a win for you? What would make this like something that you want to continue with? What metrics do we have to prove? What are we trying to test here? And then you kind of handhold them through. Do you think, what do you think about that? Are you more kind of is it more the first or the second, or how would you approach that? What would you tell someone to think about?
It's a little bit of both. The first is actually kind of up to the customer's decision. Yeah. It's possible for them to test it without integrating it. Mm-hmm. But if they do make the choice to integrate it, then it's like, thank you, the first option. But with the second one, I found that a big roadblock is actually more of a human element, where the engineers are often very, like, they don't even like that they're evaluating it because their code is going to be replaced by it. And the engineer who referred us is usually, like, it can be different, but that's a very tricky thing to navigate. And what I often say is, like, we are here to highlight your work. like, it's like very fuzzy emotional conversation. It's not like hard numbers or anything. Yeah. It's kind of like, we're here to highlight your work. You get to use our compression product, get way better performance. And then like, look, you can do all these cool techniques that we enable you to do. Like, so basically you still have a job. You still look really cool. We promise. Yeah. Yeah. And then the other element of that is, one thing, again, it's kind of like the simple things you were pointing out. We found that even though these engineers usually have a lot of experience, they still make really silly mistakes sometimes. So, but they're usually embarrassed to admit that they made that mistake. And so like diving in and checking in regularly and like basically asking if they say the evaluation didn't go so well, basically asking them that if they made a stupid mistake in a way that won't hurt the ego too much and things like that. And then we also try to get those concrete numbers as well.
Sure. Yeah. Where do we need to improve our docs? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I think that's because that's one of the things I hear a lot from people who are looking for new ideas or people when they're looking for a product to build B2B. I hear a lot this advice, like look for something in the company where they have a really complicated spreadsheet and turn that into a product. And I think that's a really, it sounds good, but I think it's really dangerous because like you said, someone has built that spreadsheet. There's probably only one person in the company who knows how to work it and they probably can't be fired while that spreadsheet still is important. So the person who's responsible for whatever you're selling to has like every incentive not to use it and not to buy it. So it can be really difficult, even though the product may be amazing.
Exactly. One mistake I made was at first I took the approach of, don't worry, like we're enabling more small companies. You can always start a small company. Like I kind of took that angle and I found that that wasn't so good. Like I needed to be assuming that they still had this job and doing well in this job. Not everyone can start a small company. Not everyone is motivated by supporting small businesses. So yeah, you kind of have to figure out how you can help them within their context.
Yeah, sure. That makes a lot of sense. Maybe we can move now more kind of onto, if we have a couple of minutes left, we can move more into the general kind of just stuff maybe that you, I don't know, any advice you think would be really useful for founders around sales. I mean, I know it's a ridiculously broad
question. Advice that I always give is just to talk to lots of other founders and entrepreneurs. Okay. Like even just talking to you in this conversation, I have learned things like even though I was doing a lot of the talking, like it's like always talk to entrepreneurs and specifically entrepreneurs in your space. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the best educations you can get because someone told me a really good analogy. They said business is like parenting advice. Like everybody will try to tell you how to raise your kid and just follow X, Y, Z and it'll all go perfectly. But every kid is different and like, you kind of have to throw out, business is the same way, like from what I've seen. So kind of keep that in mind that your business is probably an amalgamation of a lot of different stories.
Yeah, that's really good advice. That's amazing. It reminds me of whenever I go, I'm on Indie Hackers and places like that quite a lot. And I can, when I see someone I don't know, I can almost instantly guess whether they will be experienced and whether they will have good advice, be good at giving advice or not, based on the ratio of questions they ask to like advice they give. Whenever someone asks for a specific feedback, a lot of people just go in and say, here is super generic advice. This is what you should do. And people who I personally would really love to get advice from will be saying, well, firstly, how are you doing this? Have you thought about this? Maybe you should take a look at this.
Yes. Yep. That's why I'm so glad that you offered to like bring me on. Cause I'm trying to figure out how to give more helpful advice in a format like this, because you're right. Like the best advice is one-on-one and just like asking about a specific scenario. It's really tough. I admire business professors. I don't know how they do it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think something I've seen a lot as well is just a lot of people hear good advice. Like you see maybe YC Startup School, the Indie Hackers podcast. There's a lot of different places that have really good advice. But everyone wants to hear, like, does that advice apply in my specific case? And they just need to hear someone to say, this same advice you just heard, that applies to you. And that's all they need, which is, I don't know how you get around that.
Yeah, it's really tough. And I think that partially speaking from personal experience is something I try to do and some often fail at, instead of trying to generalize it. That way people can like figure out the context that it comes from.
Yeah, and I mean, the internet's big enough for there to be so many people who can really find kind of your personal experience really useful as well. So I think that's absolutely no problem there.
Right. I think the main thing I really want more people to know is that you don't need to know, like, I see a lot of newbies at business think that business deals always start from like executives or people who are directors or really high up. And the majority of our sales have started from regular engineers that have just worked for the company and referred us to the right people. As I said, even junior engineers. So like fresh out of college. And so it's like, I really want to encourage people to still pursue their company and their dream and not wait for like when they have executive connections. You can start before then. And then of course, talking to other entrepreneurs is something I can't stress enough.
Okay. So maybe we can get into the talking to entrepreneurs thing. What should I be asking?
I think it helps to have a directed goal and a reason for why you're talking to the founders. And like super directed, like I am talking to this because I want to sell to these customers and these founders have worked with these customers before, or I want to get an idea of what prices to charge, or I want to get a referral to a customer. Like be really thinking about it. And after each meeting, think about like, what did I get out of that? Okay, I learned how to price the product better. And I think the reason why people can get sucked into that is because it's not focused enough. Like they're talking to founders that really run different kinds of companies and they're trying to get like specks of advice that apply to them. Whereas I'm more thinking about like, for instance, it's been really helpful for me to talk to middleware founders to get like, because it's a very small pool, at least in games, and it's helpful to know each other and know like what did you charge, and then to go off and take that actionable item and like revise our templates or like start finding customers. And keeping that balance is very important. Like you shouldn't just learn about theory and advice.
Yeah, sure. So I do have another question I want to ask that I've just thought of, which is, I'm sure you've been going for 3 or 4 years now?
This is our fourth year. Yeah.
Fourth year. Okay, amazing. So I'm betting at some point someone has come to you and said, or you've had the thought yourself, I should hire a salesperson. And you haven't done that. Or if you have, you've quit it again. So I think it's something that happens to everybody. So I'd love to hear kind of why you haven't done that, or maybe why you haven't, it didn't work out. I don't know which yet.
It's really interesting because I think that you're going to get, I've gotten different perspectives on this topic from all kinds of different business people. I've seen cases where it's worked out really well. Like the salesperson had an excellent network and really helped bring in business. And I've heard cases where it's failed horribly, whereas the salesperson actually struggled more than the founders because they weren't respected as much as the founders were, or the salesperson took all their clients and quit. like I've heard the gamut of stories. The reason why we haven't is several reasons. First of all, it's similar to why we haven't really hired a lot of employees, is or any employees. The only people we work with are our lawyer on contract and an accountant on contract, and that's it. And the reason is, if I brought anyone on, and even with our lawyer, it's starting to be like, I want to give her more. I want to make it very equitable, and I don't just want to pay someone like a salary and then I take half the profits. I don't know. I just really want to be conscious about that. And so that always makes me hesitate a bit of like, am I compromising my integrity too much? Am I giving this person what they really deserve? Like, that whole battle goes on in my head. And then the other part is just like, do we need it? And I have personally, because for a couple years we were too broke to hire, to even think about hiring a salesperson, mm-hmm. I've already built up so many good, solid relationships, and we have the kind of business model that isn't like sell to thousands of people very easily. It's like a very manageable number of customers. So it's something that I can do. And so I kind of don't want to risk that right now.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. I see a lot of people struggle with that decision as well.
I've seen it like, yeah, it really, it's just very tricky. And I've kind of assumed a 95% business role. Whereas like I started thinking I would build half the product and I'd be very technical, and I've moved into kind of being the salesperson. So it's kind of like, it's worked out. It's not like I'm overburdened with technical tasks.
Okay. That's great. I mean, obviously you'll be doing a lot of the, what should call that lovely word, customer success, and kind of looking after people, handholding, all that stuff as well. Where would you say, maybe, I guess it's the same for you as well, is where would you say when you're talking to a new customer, when does sales kind of end? I mean, with that, where is this, like the sales, let's say the sales process or the sales funnel with that one particular customer? And so, because in your case, it's probably not, well, like in most cases, it's probably not when they close the contract, right? I mean, you'll want to be kind of keeping the, I don't want to say keeping the pressure on, that sounds a bit nasty, but you want to be keeping like a watchful eye, let's say, and helping them in a sales way, I guess.
It's very tricky because I think sales only truly ends when they can't give you any more money. And in our case, that would be an annual non-restricted license, meaning they could potentially give us more money by raising the price next year, but that's kind of difficult. It's easier to either increase in scope or something like that. So we typically always limit the scope of contracts, and therefore the sales process never really ends. It's always like, so can we use this in different parts of your company or sure. different ways? And I'm also always thinking of sales because of referrals. Yes. So like always trying to put on that sales face to be like, do you know other companies who might be interested? So it's funny, I never really turn off that sales mm-hmm. aspect of it. But once we've gotten paid, I can relax at least. but yeah, and what's interesting about our product is it's not very heavy on support. And I think that's another reason I don't really switch, is because the support tasks aren't super high. So it's like mostly sales.
Okay. That's interesting. So maybe kind of as a last question that was just something you touched on there was the like the annual contract. How do you think about pricing and structuring those deals? Because I mean, I'm guessing with the amount of, I mean, you're looking at a 12 to 18 month sales cycle, you're going to be want, you know, 6 month, 12 month, couple of year contracts, right? How do you think about that?
We've structured it in a few ways. We have three main ways we structure contracts. Well, two really. We have the yearly fee and we have per project. Per project fee is typically for projects that are going to last a few years, but they don't know how long exactly. And like games are a great example. Pay it for your game. You're good. You'll give us more money on your next game. it also works really well for consulting shops, but, and the yearly, we found a lot of customers prefer doing 3 years up front, like you said, like, so it locks it in for 2 or 3 years and then they don't pay us every year. And I don't know. I don't know exactly what to go into on that, other than one thing I've realized was why B2B companies charge so much is partially to account for those 12 to 18 month sales cycles. It's like, once you go through a sales cycle, you're like, oh, it is worth this much. Like, it's not just time too. Mm-hmm. It's a legal review. It's that costs a lot of money sometimes. So there are costs involved even in that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you take on a lot of responsibility as well, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there's inevitably like liabilities and support obligations that bigger companies would request. And it's easier to just have a higher price rather than constantly like increasing the price for every new new thing they want. So yeah, there's so much to go into on pricing though. I could ramble for ages.
I'm just thinking of all these follow-up questions now that I'm gonna price down for another time. Yeah, so maybe I want to leave people with kind of with something. So I want to leave people with something actionable that they can take away. So if someone's out there, maybe most people presumably watching this or listening to this will be somewhere between I have an idea and zero sales, and I'm doing, you know, maybe a couple of $1,000 a month, and I want to turn this into a full business that I can, you know, can support me and my family and whoever. And I appreciate that's a range, but can you maybe give me something kind of actionable, a resource maybe they can go and read, or something they can actually go and do, a question they need to go and ask people, they can kind of take away after this and just go and say, yeah, you should go and do this or think about that. You can choose a few as well. It's fine.
It's like, I think we've given some good advice to the, like, just starting out people, like talk to their businesses, get a lay of the land. Like, if you're just starting out, you probably need that like base education for the $1,000 to $2,000 a month people. That's what I was thinking about. I was like, oh, what advice is good for that? I know for me, one advice I wish I gave myself earlier was that smaller companies are actually really valuable because they can close deals faster, even though the amounts aren't as great. It's so nice to have the stability of knowing that you can take a risk and take on longer sales cycles with your big clients, because you know you have the smaller clients. In fact, Jason Fried wrote a really good article on like how nice it is to have like lots of smaller companies supporting you. And I like partially agree. He says you shouldn't charge big companies a lot of money. I still charge big companies a lot of money, but having that base is really reliable. And the other thing that I didn't understand is that cash flow is really important to pay attention to. I don't see this talked about a lot in like monthly SaaS. But for us, we're like yearly. So for instance, we have a lot of payments that come in December. So in December, we're like riding high. We're like, or we'll get like those project payments that come and give us a burst of income, but then that income isn't there the next year. And so like cash flow is actually crucial to pay attention to. For instance, in a recent deal I negotiated, I asked, it was like a partly services agreement. I'm trying to figure out how to say it without revealing too much, but it was partly a services agreement. Like we agreed to do some services in addition to licensing. And I asked for a fee up front and they were really confused. They were like, but you haven't done any work yet. But the reason was cash flow. Yeah. I knew that by the time that contract was signed, we were going to be in a dip in cash flow. They don't need to know that, but that's why I planned it that way. So like thinking about cash flow is so important.
Yeah. And also, yeah, that's, That's so true. I've been there a lot of times. It's just, you have that, especially, I think it's something, because even when you have investors, for example, as well, like you'll sit down, you'll have like this reporting, this planning for the end of the month. And at the end of the month, the end of the quarter, the end of the year, everything looks rosy because like the money goes out and the money comes in at some point during the year and at the end or at the end of the month, and everything adds up. But you have to pay people and you have to buy food and stuff in the middle of the month. It tends to be the case that people you have to pay, you tend to have to pay them earlier than you expect. And people who are going to pay you tend to pay you later than you expect, or not at all. And those two, they add up at the end of the year, but you have a real problem in the middle.
I have been so surprised at how big companies basically don't care about contract terms in terms of payment, because they know that you're not going to sue them if they're a month late, because you're a small business. They've got an army of lawyers. Like, So basically expect all big companies to be late on payment. Just expect it. And like, watch out for cash flow. I really didn't understand cash flow because I was so used to like salary and like looking at yearly numbers, and really like that monthly number matters.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's funny because I was talking to a guy on Twitter who's putting together a kind of like a seed fund, one of these seed funds for bootstrappers. And there's this calculator he's put together of, you know, how much money you should take on board or save up, depending on your expenditure, what you think your revenue is going to look like and stuff like that. But it's all at an end of month basis. So he was asking for some feedback, and I said, well, look, you have to kind of watch out in the middle of the month, because some of these people, they're going to look fine on paper, but you know, they're going to have real problems. They're going to be like 30, 40, 50K kind of in the hole in the middle of the month in some cases, based on these. And I think that's where you have to kind of, you get that kind of abstraction level where they were like, well, yeah, but you just put that on the credit card, it's fine. And we're like, it's like, well, yes, sure.
Every time I post about cash flow, every time people are like, Stephanie, you clearly don't know business. Just get a credit card, just get a loan.
Yeah.
That is not easy. Yeah. It's like, first of all, like, not everyone who starts a business has good credit. Like, hello, like we shouldn't assume that.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, I was poor for many years before going into software, and then like all kinds of life stuff happened. I don't have the best credit. And then the other aspect is that a lot of banks are very suspicious of tech companies. Mm-hmm. We actually got turned down for a bank loan, even though we had a signed giant contract, because they were like, you're a tech company, you're kind of unstable. It's like, what? And so it's not like, do not think that you can just get credit and get a bank loan. It's not as easy as it looks sometimes.
Yeah. And things will always go wrong at the wrong moments as well. Like, if you're doing SaaS, like the week where you're really struggling will be the week that Stripe or PayPal decides to freeze your account and hold the funds for like a week for auditing or something, because you reach the whatever it is, 100K, 10K limit. And they need to have a look for a week. Like, that will be like the worst time it could happen will be when it happens. But this is moving away from sales. More into a therapy session.
General business. But it's very important. From a sales aspect, you can target the smaller businesses to try to get paid sooner and like fill in those cash flow gaps. I found with small businesses, like 3 to 6 month sales cycles are doable. Like, if they're small, like talking to the founder. So yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, you have a product as well where it involves some implementation as well, even on for a smaller business. So that's like for you to get down to 3 to 6 month sales cycles, that's pretty decent. That's up there.
It's kind of like a month of chat and figuring out a good time to do the eval, a month to do the eval, and then like 1 to 4 months to negotiate a contract and sign it is kind of the breakdown. Yeah.
Great. So basically, where can people go and find you if they want to follow you?
I'm on Twitter at SE and my last name, HURLBURT. My business website is binomial.info, and my personal website's stephaniehurlberg.com.
And you do a lot of blogging there on business and sales and all that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, I do blogging, and I've got a YouTube channel as well that you can find me on. I'm all the things. But Twitter is kind of the main hub where I post all the thing, all the topics.
Okay, awesome. Well, it's been amazing to chat. I mean, I don't think I've learned this much in an hour and 10 minutes ever. So this is really exciting. I hope we get a chance to maybe do this again at some point in the future as well. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I've learned so much too. I'm so excited. I can't wait to see when this goes up.
That's it for this episode of the Sales for Founders podcast. We'll be back next week with another interview, finding out how amazing founders acquire their first customers and grow profitable businesses by doing sales. If you're a founder and you're struggling to come up with a product that people want to buy, or maybe you just need a bit of help finding your first customers, then you should head on over to salesforfounders.com. And as always, if you enjoyed the show, I would appreciate it so much if you would take a few seconds and leave a rating or a review in the podcast app of your choice. Thanks, and see you next week.